Calling the meeting to order. Seeing no member of the public present, let's go to roll call. Oh, by the way, today is, in case you didn't know, it's April the 28th.
Maria DeAnda.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Jason Gordo. Mike Lynch.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Joan Clendenin.
Here.
Jeff Grover. Michael O'Neill.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Do we have any announcements? Okay, hearing none. Public comment? No member of the public present, so we'll move on to consent items, number five.
I move that the consent calendar be adopted.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so moved. Okay, moving on to our report by PIMCO.
Thank you. Oh, good afternoon, everyone. Just by way of introduction, my name is Matt Clark. I've had the opportunity to visit with you many times in the past, so very much appreciate the time this afternoon. I'm usually joined by my colleague, Sasha Talcott. She sends her regards, but Sasha is out on maternity leave for baby number one. So it's a big development in the Talcott family. A new addition to Team PIMCO. Well, not quite. We don't have to recruit that far out in advance. And also, my colleague Tony Crescenzi, who is your lead portfolio manager, we had a scheduling challenge for this board meeting, so I'm hoping to get him out in front of the board for a future board meeting, but he also sends his regards. If you'll turn with me to page 3. Oh, and just by way of background, I've been at the organization for roughly 13 years, and I work as part of an investment professional team that only works with public pension plans. So that's a little bit about my background. There's more on page 2 for my biography, but that's not important. On page 3, what I've done is outlined the agenda that I thought would be helpful for the board this afternoon. What I prepared is to talk a little bit about performance, a bit about portfolio positioning, maybe briefly touch on a market review of what's been going on year to date, but I know that you kept very well informed in those regards, so I'll keep that brief. And then spend the balance of the time talking about our economic outlook and also an update on PIMCO. The high level there is while we have been in the news for some challenging developments over the last 6 months, things have certainly improved relative to 6 months ago and even relative to the start of the year. So a lot of positive news to share in that regard when we get to that point. Before I charge ahead, though, with that plan, does that work for the board? Is there any other things that you'd like me to focus on or cover? And also, just in terms of your time, so I don't derail your schedule, I had planned for roughly 30 minutes, but I also understand that there's often a premium to being concise. So does all of that sound acceptable to the board?
Sounds just right.
Okay, great. Well, why don't we jump right in? If you'll turn with me to page 5, we outline the performance of Stansera's portfolio. If you look in the top left-hand corner of the page, you'll see that you funded the portfolio back in May of 2010 with an initial funding value of $75 million. Over the last several years, you've increased that, and now the value of the portfolio is $111 million, just shy of $112 million. First and foremost, thank you very much for your trust and confidence in us. We very much appreciate the business relationship and the broader relationship. If you drop then down to the middle of the page, you'll see the bar charts. Those are performance by calendar years. Going back to 2011, this was a partial year for 2010. Here, the overall theme that you can very quickly see from the bar charts was strong performance in 2011 and 2012, more challenging absolute and relative performance in 2013, challenging relative performance in 2014, and year-to-date, we're basically right on top of the benchmark. If you then drop down to the table at the very bottom of the page, we give you the periodic returns. For the first quarter of 2015, the portfolio underperformed by about 0.1% or 10 basis points. If we were to roll the clock forward to yesterday's close, on a year-to-date basis, your portfolio has returned 1.88%. The benchmark's returned 1.83%, both positive. So your portfolio is very modestly ahead of the benchmark. I'd call it flat, certainly. And then as you go back further in time, at the 1 year and 3 year points, positive returns, but relative underperformance reflecting the outcomes in 2013 and 2014. And then on a since inception basis, we've modestly outperformed the benchmark by about, again, 10 basis points or 0.1%, reflecting real strong performance in years 2011 and 2012. Let me pause there for a moment. I'll touch briefly on the highlights from the first quarter and then talk a little bit more about portfolio positioning, but just pause for a moment to see if there's questions that you would like to ask about performance. Well, on page six, we give you sort of a snapshot of what were key drivers for the broad global bond market in the first quarter of 2015. Really, I think the thing that's been defining the capital markets for the last 3 months, and I guess you could argue even a longer time, is central bank policy. And in particular, what's been driving the markets most recently is a divergence in central bank policy. And we'll talk about that in more detail, but if you kind of look across the globe, there's been over 30 central banks that have engaged in some sort of easing measure, in other words, making monetary policy more accommodative in an attempt to spur economic activity, while our central bank, ostensibly, and we'll know more after the meeting this week, is on a path to reining in economic accommodation and monetary policy accommodation. And that divergence from central bank approaches has really had a big impact on the way capital markets behaved. And in particular, one of the biggest stories this year and over the last 6 months has been the rapid increase in the U.S. dollar relative to other currencies as market participants sort of step back and say, well, your central bank is going to be raising interest rates, all these other folks are going to be keeping them low, therefore your dollar is moderately more attractive than, say, the euro or the yen. Now, that's kind of taken a pause most recently, but that's been was a key driver of economic activity or economic results and capital market results. The other certainly big dynamic over the last 6 months has been what's going on in the energy market, the very significant drop in energy prices that started last summer but accelerated over the fall as Saudi Arabia stepped away from supporting prices. That had a big knock-on effect to the capital markets because it brought down inflation expectations, and we all sort of benefited from that, hopefully, in the form of lower gas prices, but even that we're beginning to see turn back around, and you've probably seen some of that anecdotally as you go to fill up your cars with higher gas prices as we move into the summer. If you turn with me to page seven, a brief snapshot on how your portfolio is positioned. And just stepping back for a moment, this is a high-quality intermediate core bond portfolio. It's there not only to generate returns, but to provide diversification and liquidity, whether it's for benefit payments or for reducing some of the volatility that other areas of the asset allocation might generate. To give you a snapshot of the overall credit quality of the portfolio, its average credit quality is AA-. By comparison, the benchmark's average credit quality is AA. So very close to the benchmark, the broader bond market, in a very high-quality orientation. By design, too, the amount of exposure to non-investment grade is limited to roughly 10% of the portfolio's market value. So again, a very high-quality orientation to the portfolio designed to generate income, but also designed to provide diversification and liquidity. If you look at the table in the top left corner, that little table that depicts interest rate exposure, what we're showing you is the interest rate exposure or sensitivity of your portfolio versus the broad market. And that number 4.7 relative to the market's 5.2 tells you that this portfolio is less sensitive to interest rate movements than the benchmark. Well, what does that mean? It means that if interest rates go up and bond prices fall, your portfolio will be hurt less. On the other hand, if interest rates fall and bond prices go up, your portfolio doesn't benefit as much. And quite frankly, over the last 3 months, indeed over the last 6 months, being more conservatively positioned in regards to interest rate exposure has been a headwind for performance, as interest rates have generally come down quite significantly, really driven by the big drop in oil prices and the drop for in expectations around inflation. All that has brought interest rates down, bond prices up. We were more conservatively positioned for that dynamic, and that's been a bit of a headwind for us to navigate through. If you look at the very last line, we have a statistic called total carry. You can think of that as roughly the yield of the portfolio. So the portfolio yields just a little bit less than 2.5%. To give you a sense of where the benchmark is, the benchmark's very close to that, also at about 2.4%. And there's different ways to measure yield. So we're using I'm using a PIMCO proprietary way here to describe it. But what you have here is a high-quality liquid portfolio yielding around 2.5%. Again, that doesn't sound like a big number, but when you factor in that inflation is running about 1.5%, you are still picking up, on a go-forward basis, a modest amount of real return from an allocation to core bonds. What's more interesting, I think, is that if you drop down to the table on the left-hand side, we take that interest rate exposure that I showed you, total 4.7 years, and we decompose it for you according to key segments of the maturity spectrum for the Treasury market. And what you'll notice is if you look at that table, is that we're underweight Treasury securities in kind of call it the 0 to 5 year maturity range. And we're also closer, just slightly underweight maturities that are called 15 years and longer. So we're basically focusing on the middle portion of the maturity spectrum, call it 10-year treasuries, is where we're sourcing most of our interest rate exposure, because we think that that's the best place to get exposure for the amount of yield you get relative to the amount of risk you take on in terms of exposure to rates. This gets into sort of our view regarding the Fed, which I'll touch on in just a little bit more detail later. Our base case is that the Federal Reserve does start hiking rates in September, and we think it's less important sort of when they initiate that and more important to think about the path they apply. And we think that this time, in this cycle, when they start raising rates, unlike last cycle or previous cycles, they won't be as aggressive. So it'll be slower and more shallow, and they'll end up at a terminal point that's much lower than what they had and ended up in past cycles, largely as a result of longer-term dynamics regarding debt and population growth. All those things are going to be a headwind that make it difficult for central banks to really bring rates back to where they had, say, been in the late 90s or even in the first half of the 2000s.
Matt, will the intermediate to long-term end of the yield curve react at all to the Fed starting to raise the Fed funds rate?
You know, typically when the Fed's, there's a lot of different scenarios here. The last time that this scenario happened, when the Fed was raising rates, the actual long end of the yield curve remained pretty stable and, in fact, rallied. And if you kind of cast your minds back, it was Greenspan talking about this great conundrum. As they were raising rates, they weren't getting 10 and 30-year Treasury rates moving up quite a bit. We think net-net, Treasury rates in general will move up as the Fed starts normalizing rates.
A little bit of a parallel shift,
and we think more of that's going to occur at the 30-year and call it the 2-year point. The 10-year point we think is going to be relatively stable because that's where it's sort of you have the most yield per unit of interest rate exposure. You would think that with a better economy and better inflation dynamics that the 30-year Treasury would be kind of at risk for really selling off. The reason we don't think that's going to be the case is because when you look across the rest of the world, the challenges facing economies like Japan and the Eurozone are so severe that our 30-year yield at 2.6% sounds quite low to us, but to everyone else in the rest of the world, a 2.5% yield sounds really, really generous. And so those long-term Treasury securities are going to have a persistent source of demand that will limit the amount that they sell off. Whereas the reason that we're more underweight the 2-year is that it's more likely that the marketplace will say, oh gosh, the Fed really is serious. They are going to raise interest rates. 2-year Treasury is yielding only 50 basis points, right? So it's not really pricing in a lot of Federal Reserve action. And there's more downside there than there is upside. And that's why we're avoiding it. So a long involved answer to the question, but just to wrap up on this page, on the right-hand side, we provide a sector snapshot. A couple things that I'll highlight here. If you look at that government sector, there's sort of cross-hatching at the very top of the bar chart. That reflects our allocation to Treasury inflation-protected securities. That's a little bit more than 5% of the portfolio's on a market value basis, but plays a bigger role in a duration perspective. The thought process is, like, we can own 30-year nominal treasuries, which do have some of this risk from higher levels of inflation and more economic growth, or we can own 30-year TIPS, which at least protect us from higher rates driven by inflation. Now, last year, owning 30-year TIPS didn't help us at all because inflation expectations came down and everyone said, boy, we really want nominal treasuries. This year, inflation expectations have kind of moved back up, and so those 30-year TIPS have performed well relative to their nominal counterparts. And we think it's a sensible hedge against the risk of higher inflation from here. One kind of also interesting kind of snapshot about the TIPS market. The TIPS market is saying right now that break-even inflation could be 1.9%. Well, the Fed's target for inflation on a medium-term basis is 2%. So if you believe that the Fed is going to achieve its target over the next 10 years or get closer to its target than not, then TIPS are a great value because inflation will be above that 1.9% level. Just a few months ago, the market was saying that the Fed would never get to a 2% inflation level. It was a 1.7% expectation. So we think for a lot of different reasons, these have a nice sort of asymmetric return profile that's very positive, and that's why we put them in the portfolio. Just a couple other highlights here. You'll notice that we're underweight investment grade credit securities, but we also have some allocation to below investment grade securities or junk bonds. When you put those together, the overall exposure to the credit sector for the portfolio is a bit lower than the benchmark, but it's closer than kind of what it appears here on the page, because when you factor in sort of the greater volatility of the high yield holdings that we have, it brings up the overall credit sensitivity just a bit. We tend to really like still financial sector issuers, so your biggest overweight in the portfolio is exposure to Bank of America. Again, we run very diversified portfolios, so for us a big weighting, if in this case the Bank of America, is at 1.4% of the portfolio. That's about a percent overweight relative to the benchmark, and that's probably about as heavy as we'd get into any one issuer, because we like to have lots of diversification. There, the story is, you know, here's an organization that is much more sound in terms of its financial footing and also is under a lot more regulatory scrutiny. That may not be great for equity holders, but it's terrific for bondholders. So again, we look for areas of the market where we can lend our money, lend your money, and have a very high confidence that we're going to get that back with interest and principal payments. Let me pause there. I've given you an awful lot of data to sort of digest in a very short amount of time. Let me just see what questions you have.
And Bank of America is not the only bank that's under a lot of scrutiny. JP Morgan.
Right.
So are you invested in some of these other ones that the government's been after?
Yeah, no, it's definitely it's a very nuanced approach. Your biggest underweight in the portfolio is Citi, actually. We're underweight Citi, we're underweight Wells Fargo. So we look very carefully on a case-by-case basis. It's not just that we sort of hand off money to the financial sector. But from a bondholder's perspective, the broader financial sector does have that more favorable characteristic as being under increased regulatory scrutiny. That's, all things being equal, a bit of a positive in that sector's camp relative to other sectors of the marketplace, which have a little bit more latitude to pursue riskier business strategies, which might benefit equity holders at the expense of bondholders. So it's a very much a bottom-up exercise in picking the issuer. But we also do think about sort of the industry dynamics, and the industry dynamics are in this case, relatively positive, again, from a bondholder's perspective. Okay. The next few pages all sort of recap what's going on in the marketplace. I really kind of hit the high points here. Page 8 is kind of a nice summary, so I'll just mention this briefly and then maybe move to the outlook. Really, the story for the global economy has been one where the U.S. has been stronger and the rest of the world has been weaker. And you see that just in terms of the Purchasing Managers Index chart that we have on the left-hand side of the page. Now, what's important is that both for the Eurozone and for the United States, this index is in a range that indicates expansion. The economy is growing. More recently, the level for the U.S. of that expansion has moderated somewhat, but it's still relatively robust. And the Eurozone, by contrast, which had been struggling for a bit, has accelerated largely as a result of what their central bank is doing to try and spur economic activity. Now, the big challenge for Europe and for other areas of the globe is a challenge that we've been dealing with to greater and lesser degrees of success, and that's one of employment. So here we have made some really nice gains in terms of putting people back to work. The last non-farm payroll number was a bit of a disappointment, but if you extrapolate the longer-term trend, we have done a good job of doing that. Other areas of the globe still face very high levels of unemployment, which will be a bit of a headwind as they navigate this recovery. All this means is that the U.S. is farther along, and which implies that our central bank should be farther along in terms of getting policy rates back to more normal levels. Let me jump ahead then to the outlook on page 12. But before I do that, any final questions on what's been going on in the market or how your portfolio is performing? Okay. Well, on page 12, we give you this map of the world, and you know, we tend to be among the most pessimistic group of people when you pull them into our room. And I always worry about boards when you hear from PIMCO last in the day, because you get to the end of the day and the PIMCO guys come in and we tell you about how everything's wrong with the world. Sort of suck all the oxygen out of the room. Oddly enough, we're relatively constructive on the global economy on a cyclical or short-term basis. So in the U.S., we're expecting GDP to grow at close to 3%. That's what we would say is near potential GDP growth. And inflation getting from a level of where it is right now, call it for 1.5% at core, towards 1.75%. If you look to other regions, there's also positive news. Places like the UK and even the Eurozone, with their central bank getting much more involved, we expect some acceleration in growth there. The one area of the world where
you don't expect Greece to pull out or to be thrown out?
You know, the consensus expectation for Greece right now is about a 30% chance that they exit the Eurozone. We're a bit lower than that. We think it's more in the neighborhood of 20%. What's important, though, is the environment today is very, very different than the environment back in 2011 when we last went through this exercise. The ECB has quite a bit more, and I would say the IMF and other policymakers have quite a bit more policies in place to effectively ring fence the potential fallout from Greece. You know, Greece, in the great scheme of things, is something like 2% of Eurozone's GDP. And so our base case is that they stay in. How it exactly plays out is very hard to say, because what's been presented in the marketplace is it's either they're in or they're out, or they default or they don't default. The truth of the matter is the final outcome is going to have a whole series of permutations along those lines. But what we feel most strongly about is that, let's say they get to the most extreme outcome, they're out of the Eurozone and they default, the impact on the European economy will be much less than it would have been several years ago, now that policymakers have basically been able to put in place policies to protect other areas of the Eurozone. Now, we're not lending money to Greece, but you know, broadly as a firm, we're constructive on places like Italy and Spain, because we think of all the things that the policymakers in Europe have done will continue to support their economy and their bonds, and you pick up you basically pick up good yield for the risk that you take on in lending to a place like Italy. So absent Greece, I guess you could say that's the cloud on Europe's horizon. I'd say the cloud on the world economy's horizon is what happens in emerging markets. There, it's a very differentiated set of circumstances. China, we think, will continue to slow. That's part of their longer-term policy objective. The question is, can they do it in a way that doesn't create a financial crisis over there? We think that they have enough tools at the policy level to do that. If you go to other areas of the emerging markets, places like Brazil, still situations where it's very tenuous and uncertain in terms of how they navigate not only their fiscal challenges, but also the political challenges that they're seeing. So on a very selective basis, there are places in emerging markets where we think it makes sense to take some exposure. A place like Mexico would be a great example. But overall, for that segment of the global economy, we think you have to be pretty cautious, because that's the weakest leg of the three stools between the U.S., developed markets, and emerging markets. And on page 13, this is maybe just something to look at and kind of, I don't know, it's just to me striking. This depicts all the policy, just a snapshot of the type of policy combination that we've seen globally. And so again, it really emphasizes the degree to which the U.S. is quite unique, and maybe Britain will be quite unique in terms of normalizing policy. We talked a little bit about the energy markets. Here, you know, our assessment is that net-net, it's good for the U.S. economy, the cheaper oil prices, but it has generated some headwinds in terms of inflation, which have translated to a stronger dollar, which has in turn kind of hit multinational companies. We think some of that will reverse course as we go through the rest of the year. And then the next several pages really sort of go into greater detail about the economic environment. I'll skip those and maybe sort of wrap up with the economic discussion on page 19. So here, some of the key themes in the portfolio that we've already talked about: underweight interest rate exposure, but very selective in where we get that. The intermediate portion of the maturity spectrum, think of, call it the 5 to 10 year treasury sector as being the place that we think you want to source your interest rate exposure. We continue to like inflation-protected securities, TIPS, particularly longer maturity TIPS. We think the dollar story has some strength left to it, but much of that move has happened. So we're not going to see the dollar go up by another 30%. You know, it might be something more like 10% over the next 30 months as opposed to 30% over 10 months. And then on the corporate credit, being very selective in identifying from a bottom-up basis the companies that we think are best positioned to pay us back and give us an appropriate amount of yield for the risk that we're deploying on your behalf. I'll wrap up, if it's of interest, with just a brief update on the organization. Again, you know, we are cognizant that we have in the news a lot, so there's probably questions there that I can answer. Any questions on our outlook, the positioning, before I move to the PIMCO update? Well, on pages 21 and 22, we really kind of give you the key facts. Really, I would point to page 22 as providing the most useful amount of data. We now manage just under $1.6 trillion in assets. Of that, $1.3 trillion is coming to us from our clients like you. If you were to roll that picture back, you know, say 6 months, that's about $300 billion less than what we had 6 months ago. So the number is very, very large. But if you put it in percentage terms, it works out to about 18% of our AUM has left the firm as a result of the organizational challenges that we've experienced over the last, we'll call it last year. Now, we don't like seeing assets move out, and it's certainly doing a lot to keep the reporters at PNI gainfully employed. And we have not yet received a thank you note from them on that. But putting this into context, we don't like to see assets leave, but it's well within the realm of what we can manage. If you think back to the financial crisis, it wasn't uncommon for other firms who had a more equity-centric business to see AUM declines of 50% and more. For us, we're far, far away from that. We will stay far away from that. And what we've seen has been well within the realm of what we anticipated to have to manage through whenever our founder decided to leave the firm.
So what percentage is it now? You just gave it.
About 18. 18%. Yeah, we've seen about 18%, yeah, leave the firm. Go ahead.
Have you ever had that kind of a loss before, that
magnitude? No, in terms of AUM loss, though, we've had to navigate much harder liquidity environments. Kind of think of it, the financial crisis, we saw a drop in our AUM that wasn't too far off from that. It was in the 10 to 15% range.
So this is the equivalent to the Great Recession of 2008?
Yeah, I would say, but the key difference is the markets are much better functioning. And, you know, the pressure has really been concentrated on the strategies that Bill Gross had managed. So of that $300 billion, a full $100 billion of it has come out of the Total Return Fund. And so if you kind of look through that headline, the broader story of PIMCO is one of a very diverse client base with lots of different strategies which are doing well. Those haven't been affected nearly as much as the U.S.-centric total return strategies that have been overseen by Bill Gross. And even there, the trend has moderated quite a bit. Last month, we saw about $8 billion come out of the Total Return Fund. Again, when I present these numbers, they sound very, very large, and they are large, but you have to normalize them for PIMCO's presence, right? At the peak, we had monthly redemptions in the neighborhood of $26, $27 billion. And so they have been steadily declining, and we expect that trend to continue as we go forward over the course of the year. Now, it's not going to turn around tomorrow. It's not going to turn around next week. We're going to have this headwind in front of us for the next, I'm certain, for the next rest of the year. But we feel very good about the trend that's been established. And most importantly, from your perspective, it has not impacted the way we manage portfolios, nor has it impacted our ability to attract and retain investment talent. One of the big fears, I think, that kind of got thrown around in the marketplace without a lot of evidence when Bill decided to leave was this fear that, oh, Bill is going to pick up and he's going to take an entire team with him. I can count on one hand the number of senior portfolio managers who have left. In fact, it's two since Bill has departed. It was Paul McCulley, who we recruited back out of retirement to work with Bill, so it's no surprise to us that he decided to go back into retirement. And then a gentleman by the name of Sawmill Parikh, who I have worked with and think the world of, he had been focused on bond portfolios and wanted to do multi-asset portfolios. We decided to give that responsibility to another member of the team, so Sawmill decided to move on to other endeavors. But the point for you, I think that's important, is that the staff, which is really what drives the investment results, has remained very, very stable. And we've gone out and we've done a good job, I think, of adding to our team in ways that are responsible, that will deliver good performance for you going forward. So I know it may not appear this way from all the things that you've read or seen in the press, but it remains a very stable and, most importantly, a very well-resourced organization, very much focused on delivering value for you and your core bond portfolio and on a larger basis for our clients, regardless of what strategy they're working with us on. That is really the key, I guess the key point. It's usually the thing that's top of mind for most of the clients when I talk about the organizational update. Any questions about PIMCO as an organization? Okay. Or more broadly, anything that we've covered so far? I think we're 2:31, so I think I'm technically right on the edge of my my objective of keeping you all on schedule.
It's been a very quiet afternoon.
It's a warm day outside. Talking about the bond market, very exciting. So you folks have done a great job retaining your enthusiasm. I want to compliment you on that. Well, maybe I could close where I left off. Thank you again for your time this afternoon. Very much appreciate the trust and confidence in PIMCO. And I imagine maybe a few of you will be coming to Sackers this year. It's in our backyard up in Anaheim. You all have an open invitation to visit us anytime, but if it's convenient for you when you make the trip down south, please know that we would love to see you if you'd like to drop by. So thank you again for your time. And again, thank you again for your business.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Kathy.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Don't let it hit you. We are at the at 6A value added. Was it? Oh, I didn't know if we wanted to look at that separately or.
So it must be lagging, but it must be looking at that.
Okay. So, no comments.
Hers, no.
Okay, so we're ready to executive director.
All right, item 7A. This is a discussion and action item regarding information technology solutions. Staff's recommendation today is going to be to select 3 trustees to establish an ad hoc committee to assist and guide staff through the implementation of multiple technology solutions. And Kathy Herman will present this.
As you know, we came to you in October and kind of gave you a snapshot of what we think we need to accomplish in the next 5 or 6 years to get our information technology up to standards to take us into the future. As you know, our pension software system, they've announced they're not going to continue supporting the system at some point. They are currently taking care of us. We have a maintenance contract, but they are no longer selling the product. So that's what started this whole thing, and it started it moving faster than we had originally thought we would. We are looking to go out for do an RFP, a request for proposal for consultants to help us through the process. And we're thinking we're going to be able to put this out towards the end of May, maybe June. And we would like to get a committee in place, and we want an ad hoc committee to help us get through this consulting piece of it and probably the pension piece of it. It'll kind of depend on what the consultant tells us. But out the gate, we need to get somebody in here to help us go forward with this. And so by getting an ad hoc committee in place now, we will have somebody to review the RFP before it goes out, and then that will be the team that will work with us to review the proposals as they come back in for the consultant. And then at that point, we'll take it forward and see if we're going to go forward. If this turns, this will be a long-term project, so at some point we may decide it has to be other than an ad hoc committee. But I would like to start with an ad hoc committee and be able to move it forward.
Is that just for the issuance then of the RFP and review?
For now. Mm-hmm. And then the ad hoc committee will determine whether or not we keep going as on an ad hoc basis, or do we need to establish a formal committee? Because I do believe this is a several multi-year project, and it's going to take some continuity in decision-making and reviewing as we go forward as much as possible. So I think at some point we will want a regular standing committee, but for now I'd like to start it out with an ad hoc to get this out the gate. Any volunteers?
I look that way.
Yes, we do have two people not here. So.
Yeah, we wanted to do three, amongst other reasons, but this is a long-term project, and it may be that the three that start off today won't be around, so we kind of, like Kathy's alluding to, wanted to have continuity. At least one person will stick around until we have turnover and so forth.
Question. Maria, were you on the C4 project?
I was.
Okay.
Indirectly.
You're
in. indirectly. I was a subject matter expert at the time on, anyways. And this is something that, I mean, I truly do feel passionate about, that we need to get on board. But one of the questions that I have in my mind, I know that when you were doing the presentation back in October, there was information that we needed to get some of our information all updated and verified. And
data.
We are working feverishly to get the data updated. The service hours contributions are fine.
Okay, so that is...
It's ongoing. We're still working on it.
We have one full-time staff on that all the time right now.
Okay, but that doesn't preclude us going in.
Not at all.
But by the time we're... Okay.
Because timing-wise, because we are also still in the middle of the investment consultant RFP, so timing-wise, I'm going to put the next one out towards the end of May, early June, so just so we can hit the meetings and, you know, not and everybody's schedules. Because it takes two to three months to get a full RFP out and back. So my understanding is there's three firms that do this consulting for this IT. So we're not looking at reviewing five or eight proposals for the consultant. And so we're probably two to three on that. And this committee will probably hopefully stay together through the review of whatever they come up with, and then to decide what's our next step. Because a consultant's going to look at us, do an assessment, and see what makes sense, and put some stuff out on the table for us. And so we're going to want the committee to look at that and say, okay, give us some feedback on that. And like I said, we may decide this needs to be a standing committee, but I do think it would be a good idea to start out with an ad hoc so we can at least start it moving forward.
So why a consultant rather than an RFP just for software?
Because of the technicality involved with the software. The RFPs for software that I've seen going out are 70 to 100 pages thick.
Uh-huh.
The idea is you spec out the entire system mm-hmm. prior to going to RFP. We do not have the ability to do that.
From 37 app systems?
Yes, the 37 app systems. We do not have the ability in-house. We do not have anybody to put that detail in place for us. I believe that this is overall for all these pieces, we're looking at 5 years minimum.
It does make sense. It does. You want people who know kind of where the trend is going, the technology side, to as well as somebody
correct
with the subject side.
Subject matter, not just, we have the experts in-house. Mm-hmm. We know what we need. We don't necessarily know how to go about getting it. What I've done quite a bit of research on it, and the systems that have brought them in on time, on budget, in a reasonable time frame, are using two or three different firms, and they're taking them from the beginning to the end. Some of them are just doing the RFP for the software. Some of them are also using that firm for testing, data conversion, various levels. And the board will have the ability to determine how much of this we want. I just do not believe we have what we need at this point in time to get this off the ground. I don't think we have the expertise to do it. I know what we went through to get the current system in, and I think if we're going to do this, we should recognize, find out exactly what we're looking at least get as much information as we can, and I do believe a firm is the way to do it. Not just continuity of decision makers on our part, continuity of staff on our part, but continuity of project management. So if one of their people drops off the face of the earth, they have somebody else. You know, at this point in time, there's not a single person on our staff that can quit doing their job to do this new job. And I just don't think we could hire enough people and bring them up to speed fast enough to bring this thing in by ourselves. So okay. That's why I'm asking to look at consultants. Have the board look at consultants. Let's do the RFP for the consultant and get an ad hoc committee together to get this thing going.
Do we have any volunteers?
I'll sit on it.
So you're looking at a three-tiered project. First, figure out who the consultant is. Then figure out what the software is. And then make it work.
Figure out what the consultant is. Figure out what software. Oh, there's like five or six possibilities that we need. Not just one software, multiple softwares. Or maybe one, but there's multiple things we have to do, yes. And then they would actually, at the minimum, I want to see our consultant stay with us until we have vendor on contract, at the minimum.
And this is really important. This is like the state is always like, you read about how the state has a $300 million computer system that doesn't work.
Right.
We don't want to be that.
So we don't want that.
We don't want that.
We had actually done that, I believe, many years ago.
Yeah, so this is really important.
We came real close last time, too.
I think you get it on the head. This is extremely important. I think, first of all, we don't necessarily, to this day, know what our precise business solution needs are. We need somebody to come in here and tell us what our business solution needs are. And then we need somebody to help us with the RFP process, going out and find somebody that can actually build this product and get it to work. And then, finally, we need somebody to manage this project, somebody to manage and make sure that we ask the consultant for the right things, and then we make sure that the consultant follows through on that. Because, as Mike alluded to, in my experience, in the two projects that I was involved in with the state, we kept going back over and over and over and asking for functionality we thought that we had asked for in the scope of the project, and it created backlogs, and the system never even got completed to its original specs. We don't want to make the same mistakes here. It's a bad business decision if we don't go down this road path. Very bad.
So Mike has volunteered.
My problem is I actually know nothing about technology. I can't get my landline phone to work. Okay, so I'm really not capable of having a discussion.
I dumped my landline.
I don't know that you need to know technology, but when we get the RFP proposals back, these are consultants. These are business people. They know the IT. We need to make sure we hire a good consultant. I definitely will have IT. In fact, I've got a meeting set up with Marsha over at the county's SBT, because she's already said that she will lend me people to help review the RFPs and stuff. So we're not trying to do this in a vacuum in any sense of the word. currently our servers are still over at the county because all our we're behind their firewall. We may, this consultant, whoever this consultant turn out to be, they may come in and recommend, in order to do what you say you want to do, you have to move away from this. And we may, the board may go, wait a minute, let's think about this. But we don't know this. We absolutely don't know. We don't know the extent of what's out there. And until I get some people in here to help us learn this stuff, and that's what I'm asking for, is a committee to help me review these business processes, and not so much the process, but the businesses, the proposals that come in.
What other county has done this recently?
Sacramento is currently doing it. Fresno is finishing up their pension software, and Merced's done it. Santa Barbara, Ventura, Imperial. Every one of them is in some variation of this process, and those that have used a consultant, every one of them has said to me there's no way they could have gotten as far as they got without having a firm take this through, be the intermediary between them and the vendors.
So does anybody on the board have an issue with hiring or going through the process to hire a consultant?
The board actually directed me to do this.
Okay, then let's do it.
October, no, February. It was February. They told me to go out and find, do the RFP, okay, and get some people in here to talk to you.
Do you know anything about the consultants in other counties?
Yes, I've actually spoken to a couple different ones. They all found me when I was at the general.
Pardon me?
They all found me when I was at the last CalPERS training. They sought me out, so I did have a conversation with all three. Which I was looking for information,
sure.
So I, you know, I didn't mind that.
No.
But the word is out already that we're getting close to going here. So the people who do this consulting all did find me. Not that that matters, but I was hunting for information.
I'd be willing to work on this, but timing may be a little bit of a concern because we've got the other RFP going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to make sure that I have enough time available that I can actually do this.
I agree totally. And that's why most of our proposals review should be finished with the one before we even get the others in. That's partly what my calendaring of this whole process is not to overburden those of you who are trying to help me get this done.
Okay, well, put me on it.
Okay, I have Mike and I have Maria.
And Donna.
Yeah, put my money where my mouth is.
You don't want to do this, Donna?
I am concerned about having enough time.
Let's see, who are our retirees?
Oh, Michael.
I don't know if you understand enough about this.
Yeah, but at least you could have it in Zurich.
Not a twist arms, but even if I had two is a good place to start.
How about if we start with two
for
now?
That's fine.
And as we go forward, we'll start the...
Yeah, I may be thinking one of the two that are absent today, you know, I would feel no guilt. Maybe a little fear, but no guilt in assigning.
Maria and I have worked together before, so...
All right.
Good team.
That could either be a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying.
I don't think so.
You don't need to.
Okay, we've got two volunteers. Thank you.
Let's see. Discussion action?
I guess I don't actually need a discussion and action.
Okay.
Ready. Direct lending.
Now you can turn off the lights.
This is item 7B. This is a discussion and action regarding the decision to deploy additional assets to the direct lending asset class. So the issue at hand today is the alternative asset class will actually never reach the intended target of 7.5%. In October of 2012, as asset liability study, the board decided to allocate 7.5% to this asset class. So that's the issue at hand today. The reasons for the shortfall are pretty simple. Portfolio loans are very short duration for the most part in all three of our lenders' portfolios. some buyers actually, borrowers actually pay back quickly, quicker than what's assumed, and then the fund may simply run out of time. They don't have enough time before the investment period closes to invest all the capital that they thought that they would invest. So there are corrective ways to fix this problem. We can actually get into funds earlier in their formation will help. Roll distributions over into serial funds. A lot of our direct lenders, some of our direct lenders actually have funds 2, 3, 4, and 5, and they're set specifically for this reason. And there's also something called evergreen funds, where they are just continuous funds and they never really exhaust themselves. So staff sees four ways to proceed today. One is do not allocate any more capital to these investments and just simply let them exhaust themselves naturally. Fund the classes to its intended target, 7.5%. Want to let you know that right now we're about at 5.3% of the total portfolio, which represents, it's a shortfall of about $40 million to this target. And I can tell you that if we do nothing, that number will continue to fall as a percentage of the total portfolio. Another thing we can do is wait until the asset liability study in the fall. And then there's a fourth option, and I'll talk about that a little later in the presentation. If the board decides today that they want to continue to fund this target, then there are a few more questions that we're going to need to ask. We're going to need to find out if you want to make this a rolling investment where we just keep the 7.5% target as close as we can. If we decide today to fund the target, do we want to entertain one or more of our current managers, or should we look for new ones? And if we consider our current crop of managers, should we re-interview them? One of the things that we said the potential solution is to wait until the asset liability study in the fall before we make a decision. A couple reasons for that is that, one, simply the investment landscape could change. I don't think it will, but it's possible that it could change. And when I say the investment landscape may change, I think what I'm talking about more is the context of the risk and reward profile of this asset class and how it fits in StanSara's total portfolio. And also, we have potential for a new consultant by the end of the year, and they may have differing opinions on what we should be doing with that asset class. So those are the advantages of waiting until the study, our new study, which is just 6 months away. We're happening upon it very quickly here.
Rick, what do we do with the uninvested monies?
It stays a part of the rest of the portfolio.
Okay.
Pretty much.
So we would take a kind of in the rebalancing aspect, just move or part of just draw money from another of our money managers to meet our goal.
Exactly. In fact, today we're probably the biggest overweight in the portfolio is domestic equities. Mm-hmm. We're about $140 million overweight from its target. And so that's where the direct lending right now, if we were putting money in it, we would be pulling from that asset. So that the imbalance is really the domestic equity and the direct lending asset class. Those are where the two biggest imbalances exist. And we actually have an agenda item later on today that discusses rebalancing, and it addresses a little bit of the domestic equity overweight.
Right.
Quick question for the ask. If we wait until the asset liability study, you gave a figure, I think it was 5.3 or something like that, invested, what would the expectation be that would go down to?
Yeah, so that I figure it'll go down to about 5% because I asked all three direct lenders to give me a projection of what the capital balance would be at the end of the year, and it turned out to be about 5% in the portfolio. So that will continually go down, and that's about where we'll be.
But it's 5.3 now?
Right, we're about 5.3% of the total portfolio. And another thing I wanted to let you know is that even though we are 2.2% below the target, we're still well within the ranges that we set on this asset class. I think the ranges were 2.5 to 9, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
So we're still well within the ranges. And the ranges, I think, were probably purposefully set wide because we knew that the ability to fund this asset class would be problematic.
Especially ramping into it. Yeah. Takes some time.
The ability to reinvest in the fall. Only Raven, I spent a lot of time on the phone with all three of the direct lenders last week. Only Raven may be the fund that has no capacity in the fall. They have a fund that's going right now. It currently has $350 million cap, approximately $350 million. $5 million cap on the amount of money that they'll take in for that fund, and they're about 40% funded or committed.
Around 200 of that 350 is spoken for.
Okay. Again, we'll talk about a solution that we came up with later on. Medley and White Oak both have funds open. That's not an issue if we want to wait till the fall if we were to get into any of their funds. And then, obviously, we can always look at other managers in the fall.
What's the likelihood that we ought to look at other managers?
I would defer that question to those gentlemen at the end of the table.
We're very positive on direct lending.
I have a problem with direct lending, as everybody knows. When we first got into it, we weren't sure what we're getting into. Among other things, we got into payday loans. The federal government has created Operation Choke Point. I'd like to remind everybody that the purpose of that is to cut off funding for payday loans. Who's doing the funding of payday loans? Stancera. So we have an immediate direct contradiction with what the federal government's doing. We've had our people that we've been dealing with caught in subpoenas, law cases, investigations, all sorts of things that are going on. While they have not been found guilty in California, the judge apparently threw that case out, they have been found in violation in several states. I've already given Rick a set of questions that I want to ask at least one of our vendors. Perhaps it'd be useful if I pass that out to everybody so you know what I'm talking about.
The direct lending doesn't all go in, our investment.
We can easily, as Bloomberg asked me, state that we didn't know the direct lending went into payday loans. I don't think we can state that anymore because we know for a fact that it does.
I'm saying, though, that we don't necessarily have to. I think we also talked about making exclusions for certain investments.
I'd like to bring your attention to the fact that, you know, maybe I'm the only crazy person. I don't think so. I don't know how many people, when they build a biography or do a web state, what they're against. Most of the time we say we're in this particular department, we're for this particular case, we want to accomplish certain things. The San Francisco Treasurer Tax Collector states that he's created programs aiming to give citizens access to bank accounts to lessen the need for check cashing and payday lending. He's right there in statement that are many treasurers who feel payday lending is wrong. We haven't discussed the moral aspect, I agree. But I think at minimum we have to recognize there are multiple lawsuits going on, multiple people asking about this, and I think it's a short time until they ask who's funding this.
Well,
stuff.
I think we just need to get through this presentation, and then we can discuss and decide what we want to do, and certainly taking into consideration your concerns, we can decide which direction we want to go.
Thank you for listening.
One thing I will bring up is that we have $95 million under management in our direct lending class, and that only one manager has one investment in payday lending.
Incorrect.
No, that's all that we see. That's all. Medley does have not any more investments in direct lending.
I have not seen anything.
Yeah,
yeah,
we've communicated this. We totally have. I've been on the phone with you on this. And then the other thing is that in the future, in these future funds, all three managers have told us that we can opt out of any investment that we want in the future.
Knowing is
in White Oak?
Deciding.
All three of them. But as far as I know, there's only one more investment left, and that's in the White Oak portfolio.
Perhaps we should have SIS investigate.
What's that?
Perhaps we should have SIS investigate to find out what's going on rather than making it a board member problem.
Do you guys know that if there are any more direct lending investments in any of the other
I'd recommend you try Think Finance and a few other things.
Medley's out, and I believe White Oak has one.
And Raven has none.
Raven has never been in the space. In fact, they reach out to us a couple times just to talk about it. They've opted against it.
Right, so, Gordon, do you think the information is in error, or I think they're lacking in understanding of some of the problems. Yes.
Okay. Why don't we move on and
all right.
The presentation?
So if we wait until October to invest, we estimate that it costs about $1 to $1.2 million per investment if we were to wait. Because we lose the ability to capture some free fee breaks that the direct lenders are offering. There would be a larger carried interest. And then also, all these funds have these systems set up to where the late investors have to pay interest back to the fund for monies that they should have been invested from the inception to the point in time that they actually got into the fund. So they would have to pay an 8% interest charge to get back into these investments later on. So it would also cost a little bit, and we estimate about $1 to $1.2 million per fund that we invested in through waiting for October. Now, there was an alternative solution, and I talked to Raven about this, and I'll be honest with you, the reason I chose to talk to Raven about an alternative solution is because their assets seem, they're more hard assets. They invest a lot in transportation, infrastructure-type investments. They don't have any payday loans. They don't have any investments like that, and they never did. So I talked to Raven about some alternatives to funding this asset class for us, and even though their capacity may be done in October or November, they gave us the ability, if we were to agree to commit $15 million to the new fund by June, that they would reserve an additional $60 million capacity in October. That doesn't mean we would have to continue to fund it in October and give them a penny more. It just reserves a place for us until October if we want to wait and make a decision after we've had the discussion on social investment and so forth.
I could be wrong, but I think that 60 cap was potentially for a higher minimum.
That's not the answer I got
okay.
from Josh.
Okay.
Actually.
That's fine.
Anyway, and if we did that now, that would preserve our most favored nation rights in terms of fee breaks and carried interest. We would still have interest payback to the fund for the earlier investors that got in before us, but it would
Correct.
Be much smaller.
Correct.
The advantage to this alternative solution is it allows us to wait and to consider the asset liability study in the fall and determine if that's still an asset class that looks attractive to Stan Serra. And it also preserves somewhat of a lower fee structure as well. So our recommendation at the moment is to agree to commit the $15 million to Raven 3 and wait until this fall to decide whether to continue to fund this asset class. That's our recommendation, but I'm not dead set on jumping onto that horse and riding it to the finish line, but I kind of like the idea we came up with through Raven. It does preserve our ability to take a harder look at this asset class. We don't have to make a decision right now. And also, it saves us some money, too. If we do this now, it'll save us some fees if we do decide in October that that's something that we want to do. So I'll throw it open to questions.
I like saving the fees idea. If we think we're going to continue in this direction, then we should lock in the lower fees.
Kelsey, is it still taking you as much time as it was at the beginning to balance it and make all of the payments and do all the back end work that needs to be done?
Of course, we've gotten better at the whole accounting thing. Natalie went to training, which the training was actually on the limited partner side of it, not on the client side of it. So she learned how they do their, and it gave her more ability to ask questions. So no, we've got all that stuff in place now, and we have our processes in place. Timing-wise, if we went with Raven, added $15 million to Raven, they would send us a new LPA and a new side letter, and as long as everything, and we would, Hanson Bridget has software so they can verify that nothing's changed. They don't have to read every piece of it to make sure it's changed. I have software that can look for differences. As long as nothing has changed in the original documents, the new one that they send us, that should be fairly simple as far as processing it. So no, it's not near as much work as it was at the beginning. And we still have, as we've gone into the infrastructure loans or infrastructure investments, we still have capital calls and stuff that we're dealing with anyway. So it's just another piece of the pie. We've got people all set up to do this stuff. So it's moving forward quite smoothly.
Nate, my next question is for you. When we originally went into direct lending, one of the reasons that we did go into it was because there was a perception that there was a disconnect in the banking community where this middle market was not being serviced appropriately. Do you still feel that disconnect exists?
And for how much longer?
That's a fantastic question, and that is absolutely the epicenter of knowing or deciding, is this an asset class we want to be a part of? And our friends at PIMCO kind of alluded to it a little bit when they talked about their investment in the Bank of America and like increased regulation in the primary banking industry has created a sustainable disconnect in the lending markets. And in particular, those profitable companies that are a bit smaller outside of the high yield market need access to financing to simply run a business. If I was to highlight an example that Raven's very intimate with, is called Turf Terminators. They go up and down California and replace people's landscaping with tax state subsidies to be able to have landscaping that's much more water friendly. They're just simply growing, and they need to hire. They have to get working capital, so that's a prime type of company.
Literally growing.
No pun intended.
Yeah, I got it.
No pun intended.
Yeah, actually,
we're in the process of looking at it as well in Stockton.
Yes, no,
so, but for a company like that, that's enterprising and industrious, they can't get a banking loan because they haven't been in business for 2 years. But they're growing at 50% a quarter. So they're willing to pay short-term high interest rates that will get them the track record necessary to get cheaper financing 2 years down the road. Those are fantastic relationships, and especially why we're bringing Raven to the board. That is a manager that I have spent an incredible amount of time due diligencing. We have up and down our client roster Ravens littered in portfolios. We have high conviction, and as far as their partnership with the plan, we have 2 years of a working relationship here where we understand what that relationship feels like, and I'm very confident and pleased to bring that and support that recommendation to the board.
So this is your, you guys concur?
Well, I got to admit to you, I was kind of wanting to tread a fine line here. I didn't want to make it seem to you guys that we had to do this right now, and I wanted to give you another option. I'm just as comfortable agreeing to start the whole process right now and get up to the 7.5%.
The 40 million?
As I am doing 15 million and waiting and discussing this more in October. I'm kind of on the fence.
Okay, can I just go to
sure.
If we do the whole ball of wax right now, do we save more money, more fees?
Yes.
A lot more fees.
I like the way you think. So we have, let's look at this as option one, the full amount, 40 million, the whole ball of wax, and option two, going with this partial investment, 15 million. So this is an action item, so which direction do we want to go? Is anybody willing to make a motion?
Before anybody makes a motion, if you choose to decide to make the decision today to go the full 7.5% was set back then. We need to decide if this is something we just want to continue funding, or once we make the $40 million, it's going to be about $40 million more to this asset class.
Additional.
Once we make that additional amount, do we stop there, or do we make this a rolling investment? And the other question is, are we comfortable with one or more of our current managers, or should we be seeking other managers?
We got three already. I think that's enough.
Yeah. Okay.
How is Raven doing compared to the other two?
In terms of IRR, internal rate of return is in between, they're in the middle. But I got to caution you that it's very premature even now to start looking at IRRs because we are coming out of that J curve, and those are going to be changing quite a bit based on distributions, and also probably more importantly, the way they value these assets, the way these value assets are valued as we go along. So I wouldn't put a lot of stock in the internal rate of return, but Ravens right now is about 5.5%, which is right in the middle between White Oak and Meadows.
Raven in particular, because they had a shorter period to have the money come back over the next 12 to 24 months, is going to, that IRR is going to ramp up significantly into ideally the double digits if you look over a 12 trailing month period.
But this new investment wouldn't necessarily, or this increased investment wouldn't necessarily be reflected in that return, would it?
It would be a separate line item.
Right.
Functionally, bless you, functionally.
And its own little J curve.
So there would be a J curve associated with it. From a practical standpoint, as it relates to this plan, they've modeled some scenarios where they would attempt to match capital calls with distributions of Fund 1. So capital calls of Fund 3 would line up to some extent with distributions of Fund 1, which ideally that there provides some efficiencies in funding the new investment.
Now, since I realize from questions I've asked previously that I completely misunderstood about a 7% return on these investments, and that that was just sort of a ballpark guess what the return was going to be. Do we have a new ballpark guess on what the return of these will be?
So that's a very good question. And the way that we model, when we model, I'll let John chime in a little bit when it comes to modeling since he's the head of the quant team, but we model the asset class in totality. So while these managers have very different risk-return profiles, when we model the asset class, we look at the premium that's being afforded to the marketplace, so let's say LIBOR plus a hurdle, and that hurdle is represented to, let's say, the middle market. So the middle market is a very identifiable sector of the industry. You can go online and Google, you know, the middle market, and they have a monthly report, and it shows you where spreads are at. And LIBOR plus 400 to 700-800 seems to be the ballpark for senior secured first lien type direct lending.
LIBOR plus 4.
Now, that I give you a range between, let's say, 4 to 8. But 4 is very conservative, and that's probably, you know, prudent when it comes to modeling. When we do direct lending, there's other premiums that are factored into the total return. So I'm quoting you simply more or less where the market is in terms of interest.
Where is LIBOR right now?
Very low.
Under 1%?
Yes.
And do we expect it
4%
return? To fall? I mean, PIMCO was just talking about, you know, rate cuts. Do we expect LIBOR to fall?
So LIBOR in terms of, I would, anything could happen.
Of course.
And if I could answer that. I,
absolutely. Given that.
I want to raise. But that said, given the interest rate environment that we're in the U.S., and we're talking for this conversation, U.S.-centric investments,
LIBOR is not LIBOR.
Right.
If you could think of what LIBOR is essentially cash.
The return you get on cash.
Okay. Cash.
Yeah. So what you're actually talking about is, so when their discussion was, well, the Fed is going to increase rates. Well, the idea would be, along with their increase in rates, you would expect LIBOR basically to move lock stock up with it.
Yeah.
LIBOR, you wouldn't necessarily base on U.S. rates.
So it's
a U. It'll be a U.S. LIBOR.
Oh, U.S.
Okay, so it's London.
I mean, when you're talking about London interbank rate, you would think that that would be more.
Right, but the change to the U.S. and London.
Okay.
So yeah. The U.S. gets considered in that equation. But very astute to know the acronym of LIBOR. That's very,
so
that's very good.
You're
dangerous.
Yeah. So generally, it's a cash rate. So as rates go, and that's one of the attractiveness of this asset class, is that if rates go up, you'd expect it's LIBOR plus. So as if the Fed starts increasing short-term rates and LIBOR goes up, you know, these the rate you get on these loans ratchets up with it, without kind of losing a cost and an interest rate penalty. Okay. So I mean that's one of the reasons we like it, because in this kind of environment, it's a hedge against rising interest rates, as well as it's an environment that spread is an attractive spread.
So
it's kind of those two things make this why we actually like these kinds of investments.
So your modeling would suggest that LIBOR plus 4, so we're probably talking 4.5 to 5.5 over the next few years, maybe a little higher.
We think it'd be for direct lending. There's there's two things. You know, there's kind of the broader direct lending or broader
middle
floating
market.
Rate note market, mm-hmm. bank loan market, and then there's private direct lending. And one of the things you would expect out of privates is there's a liquidity premium.
Liquidity premium. Yeah.
Okay, and so that these are all characteristics that we like about this investment. It's got the floating rate. It's got a nice spread, and then it's also a liquidity premium when you don't necessarily need the liquidity. For this, so all those put together, we say, hey, this is still a nice little piece of investment, and excuse me. Over the long term, you might expect, we have a hurdle rate in the performance report of 9%. We think that's high, but 7-8, a little bit less.
So you're still thinking 7%, even though we're not really seeing that yet on.
Oh correct. Yes.
Right. And that's the J-curve, right? So yeah, I mean, those are the things. And it's interesting. You talked to the managers, and then you said, "Well, I'm happy if you give me 7%." And they'll say, well, I'm going to get you, 10 to 12?
So Raven targeting net 10 to 12.
Right. Which we always take what the manager says and discount.
And then we discount it.
And what's the duration?
So the loans for Ravens are 2 to 4 at the very long end, but they huddle around 2.
Yeah. There's how they originate it, and there's actually what it actually
right.
comes out to. So they may originate it saying, well, this is a 2 to 4 year loan.
Companies
but
finance.
Usually, most of the loans don't even go to maturity.
But given that, I mean, and the comments you said earlier, I mean, a company, say, like this
Turf Terminators.
Bam. They can't get a lower interest loan because they haven't been in business that long. I'm going to make an assumption that once they have been in business for 2 or 3 years, they're going to refinance that,
yep.
hopefully at a lower interest rate.
And that's exactly.
And they're
yep.
going to pay the loan back.
Yep.
Which would mean that, Raven or whoever is going to pay us back earlier than expected, which would mean a lower return.
It's a higher
IRR. If they can't deploy the capital, then it right. turns into a lower return.
Okay.
But as banking loosens up, which is, I understand, is beginning to happen.
Unless the regulations
increase. What's the need for this niche of the market? Kind of go away.
If that did happen, it could have a headwind. But for my purview, we're seeing increased regulations
yeah.
come down to lending institutions.
So
you
where
put it this
40
way:
million? Where's it come from?
And what's our current return on domestic equity?
Last month, 0.
One of the things, now when you say $40 million, this money gets committed over time. And so what's going to actually happen, even if you do this commitment and you did nothing else, you'd be getting capital back from the three existing investments as the other ones are being called. And even with an additional $40 million, you still may not stay at 5%. You may actually be dropping a little bit below that. Over time, and it depends on how long, what additional commitments you might make in the future.
Well, I think what would happen is if you committed 40 today, you'd bump up your 7.5%, but that would be probably your high water mark, and you'd start to decline.
Right. In another year, we'd need to come back.
And then, that's just the nature of these investments.
So right now, it looks to me like our domestic equities are running anywhere from. Sorry, wrong page. Where are we at?
asset class. Fiscal year to date about, well, 6.7 fiscal year to date on U.S. equity blended. Is that right?
Talking about return?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the year to date, fiscal year to date for San Sierra return.
So we would be giving that up in order to do this.
Past returns are no indication of future performance.
Of course.
I read that a lot in this report.
This show is broadcasted for profit. $250,000 fine. So we're modeling, we actually just had an IPC meeting yesterday, and as president of the IPC board, Mr. John Meyer, he can attest to our expectations for the large cap domestic asset
class. Exactly. We just we just went through this process, so our current expectation, our new expectation for U.S. large cap equities is 7.1, will now be 7.1%.
Which has been ratcheted down continually over the last 5 years.
It just keeps coming down and down and down and down.
So you talk about our...
That's nominal. That's not real, that's nominal.
So that includes inflation.
So
your real is going to be...
That's 2% less than that. Then.
Right.
Yep, exactly.
5%.
I read an article in Barron's Weekend that talked all about that. Right. They're lowering the expectations down.
Yep. So, you know, kind of on that basis, you could look at this as you're getting diversification, you're getting similar return, similar, I'm not going to say the same, I won't say higher or lower, and probably at a lower level of risk versus the stock market, if what we say holds true. Now, again,
all things being
equal. I would be reasonably happy. I'd be really happy if this gets you the same return as public equity. If it gives you a little bit less, you know, that would be okay too, because it's going to give you a lot more than your fixed income portfolio.
How would you rate its risk?
It's less. It'll be more than fixed income. But it'll be greater. It will be greater than fixed income.
Less than equity.
Significantly less than equity.
If the board chose to invest today to go the $40 million route and get us up to 7.5% as quickly as possible, would you suggest diversifying it across our current manager space, or would you suggest giving it all to one?
Raven is the candidate that we feel is leading the pack.
So why do you feel that there's no advantage to diversifying across our current?
We can. It's just a function of economies of time and being able to diligence it. But on the other hand, it's a function of saving fees and be efficient with the conviction. As Mr. O'Neill has accurately highlighted, the benefits that are associated with there's absolutely economies of scale by investing a larger sum with one manager. But I'm not against it. We can diversify. I wouldn't recommend three managers. I would say two is more than enough if we wanted to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at that. You're talking about $40 million out of a $1.8 billion fund.
Right.
And it's a small piece, and then further diversification is kind of not necessary. You can do it, but if you've got a group of three, you say, okay, I've got to put money to work right now. Who do I have the most confidence in right now? Well, it's not going to ruin the strategic plan. So a little concentration, I don't think is bad. I think I personally prefer making bigger bets with higher confidence managers.
It's easier to blame the consultant too and force them to make one decision.
Personally, I like Raven better. They're more transparent. I feel their reports are easier to read. The investments are more concentrated. They don't have as many investments. And I, as I said earlier, they seem to be more hard asset type investments, which make me feel a little better as well. So if I had my choice, I would go with Raven as well.
I don't have a problem with Raven. My issue is why are we taking it out of, you know, of, why not international equities?
That's an issue we're going to talk about.
And then within the second item, that, you know, it's like Capital Prospects seems to be performing well, much better than the Dodge and Cox fund. So why do we take it out of Capital Prospects and not Dodge and Cox? It just doesn't seem to make sense.
The whole point of rebalancing sometimes doesn't counter.
Yeah, but if you balance somebody goes to doing really good. So you balance, take away from there, and give it to somebody who's not doing as good.
Yes.
And there's been performance
yes.
history over the year. That seems to me that...
Can't you average cost your investments at home?
That's a very good point. It's a very good point.
It's the same thing.
Mike, one of the things I can tell you is that based on the asset liability study of 12, we are really, really overweight in domestic equities right now because they have performed so well.
Okay, I get that. I get that. But if we're talking about investing, using some of that money for some other fund, it seems to me that within domestic equities, we would pick the funds that were doing the worst.
So well, why do you want to mess with them?
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that we can talk about. We don't have to discuss today.
But we do if we adopt your recommendation.
Well, there's the larger rebalancing discussion two items down. We'll get more into that. Now,
maybe we should defer.
Well, I was going to say, if...
We can talk about mean reversion and the value of selling high and buying low. In terms of where this fund is positioned, we're slightly underweight our target in international equities, and we're significantly, as Rick alluded to, over target when it comes to domestic equities. Domestic equities has been a placeholder for some of these investments that we knew were coming down the pike, i.e. infrastructure, real estate, and to a certain extent, direct lending. We have benefited significantly. This plan is one of the top performing plans in terms of return in the nation, primarily because we've had that disciplined exposure and it's favored overweights equities. I mean, very, very simple, and that has contributed dollars to this plan above and beyond most. But we are at a point where the rally, as I read today, of the 33 bull markets in the history of the Dow Jones since 1900, this is the fourth longest bull market. Never would a consultant risk calling a top in a bull market, and by no means am I mentioning that, but it has gone on now 7 years, and we are afforded a prudent opportunity to diversify in asset classes that their fundamentals are poised for future growth. When we talk, I haven't got to my flash report. The United States, as Matt said at PIMCO, is tightening in terms of their monetary policy. Europe has just released the floodgates, and we'll see that in terms of the first quarter, or let's say the last quarter returns, over 5% in developed international equities, and our conviction is that equities, in terms of international exposure, are poised to continue that rally. And you have headwinds, you know, existing in the U.S., so some of that is prognostication, and the other is just the theory, as Rick mentioned, of mean reversion. There is historical reversion to the mean, and we would expect that, especially after a long bull market. This is a unique opportunity to rebalance, and it's important that we sit here and have conviction in that for you.
Would this board feel more comfortable if we came back at the next meeting and gave you a more specific idea of where we will take the money from within the domestic equity portfolio? Because we do have a month more time. We don't have to do this right today.
Is this something we could do after the discussion on D?
It just depends on how comfortable everybody in the room feels. I mean, we can get as granular as you'd like.
No, I understand that you want to stick to the form, and the bull market's coming in. I get all that. But I'm really skeptical of international equities. I think the world's on some tipping points, which are not positive. And, you know, I don't think the formula trumps, you know, the Soviet invasion.
No, it's a real thing.
So, right. Rick, we should enable this and come back to this after D,
Yes.
One last question. If we take the 40, maybe we cover it with that. If we take this $40 million out of domestic equity, what does that do to the ratio? And you'll probably maybe get into that.
Between domestic
And moving it into direct lending.
Well, if we took it, we would be where we need to be on direct lending, but we would still be overweight on domestic.
Yeah. We're that far overweight.
Yes, we're that far overweight.
Okay, and I just have one more question. Okay, so we talked about the savings in fees for doing the $40 million now was greater than the savings on fees of doing only $15 million now and waiting until how much different?
Million or two?
I mean,
8% probably $1 to $2 million. I guess I'd have to go back and.
You know, if it's a six, you know, say it's 6 months, 8%, 4%, so 4% of $40 million is 1.6 million.
Yes.
Yeah, kind of
1 to 2. 1 to 2 is my guess.
So
that our portfolio would not increase by that amount.
That we would have to pay in fees.
Pay that, yeah.
We'd have to pay it in fees if we chose to
then later,
move forward.
Later.
Exactly.
If after the study and all that business,
yeah,
that we still decided that was an area we wanted to necessarily.
Yes.
And that's a function of the industry. That's not a manager specific thing. There's a catch up of 8% across the board for any direct lender we go into outside of the first close.
And that would total $1 to $2 million.
Based on the commitments we're talking about, yes.
Okay. So we're going to postpone it until after.
Postpone it? Okay.
We're going to postpone it, yep. So that takes us to C.
Okay. This is going to be easy compared to the last session. As you know, we went out for a request for proposals for a financial auditor. We've had Macias, Gina, and O'Connell for the last 6 years. They've done a fine job. They've done their work. They were invited to submit a proposal. The evaluation team consisted of Trustee Grover, Nellie Elliott, our retirement accountant, Deanne Corbisser, our assistant, and myself. And we reviewed all of the submittals prior to opening any of the pricing. And we ended up with two finalists, Macias, Gina and O'Connell, and Brown Armstrong. Brown Armstrong was our auditor prior to going with MGO. And Brown Armstrong is also the county's auditor. They also have 11 of the 37 Act systems. So they are between, and I think MGO has 5 or 6 of them. So between the two auditing firms, they were very equal in their ability to do the job we're asking them to do.
So you don't know the fees yet either?
I do know the
fees. Oh, you do know
the
fees.
Yes, we did. Because we'd already met, we know MGO, we've been working with them, the audit team's been working with them, our internal governance team, for the last 6 years. We felt it was important to at least meet with the other finalists, which was Brown Armstrong. The team met with them today. Given the nature of the evaluation that we did, the fees, and our interview, the team would like to recommend that we retain Brown Armstrong as our auditor for the next 3 years, with an option to extend for an additional 3.
The last time we went out for our financial services, their fees were considerably higher.
Well, they corrected that this
time.
Yeah,
just the opposite.
It was completely opposite this time. And
okay.
Like I said, truly we did a thorough review of all the submittals prior to looking at the pricing, because we didn't want our decision to be tainted by that. And they are both very well qualified firms, and it never hurts to have a fresh set of eyes look at stuff every few years. So the team and Jeff agreed wholeheartedly that we recommend Brown Armstrong to be retained. So I do need a discussion and action on that if you have any questions.
I'll make a motion that we hire Brown Armstrong as our audit team.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, so moved.
We need one more motion to authorize the executive director to sign all the documents and enter into the agreement. If I can.
I'll make that motion.
Thank you.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion. We have a motion and a second to allow the retirement administrator to sign the documents to contract. Yes, with Brown Armstrong. Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay, so passed. A little more enthusiasm.
I told you it was
getting tired, huh?
Good job, Kathy.
Okay, now we move to D.
This is item 7D, it's a discussion and action act regarding portfolio rebalancing. And I'm going to let Kathy say just a few words here and then we'll turn it over to John.
Okay. In the past, we've never added our own cover sheet to a discussion and action item that belonged to a consultant. But what we've been trying to do over the last 3 years is to improve our record keeping. It was never bad to begin with, but we're trying to get better at it all the time. And we have decided that for all discussion and action items, we'll have a Stan Sara cover letter on them or a cover sheet on it, so that as we go forward, the people who come behind us, we will be able to find things as they're digging through records, and it'll just be a little more uniform. So that's why you're seeing a Stan Sara agenda item on this. They know the stuff, so. Going to let them talk about it.
Okay. So in your packets, a memo. I believe it's fairly straightforward. Let me kind of give our rationale for some of these decisions of why and where based on previous discussions. I would say we are generally firm believers of abiding by policy, and that becomes a roadmap of these are long-term decisions, and one of the things we always try and do is say, okay, unless we really have a strong reason why not to do something, we keep saying, okay, let's stick with the long-term policy. Now, one of the if you look at SIS's presentations from day one, one of the things we always talk about is human nature risk. And that being taking your most recent experience and extrapolating it linearly into the future. And usually rebalancing, manager decisions, and the like are kind of, that's where human nature risk comes in, both on a good side and the bad side, by saying, here's a manager that's underperformed, I should not fund them. Here's an asset class that is underperformed, I should not fund it, and vice versa. Here's an asset class that's done well, here's a manager that's done well, why should I take money away from something that's done so well? And we just believe it's a discipline, is to in managing the risks of the portfolio, the returns of the portfolio, to basically stick with the plan and minimize the kind of the risk that you might take by not doing those rebalancing. So, when we with this rebalancing, we're saying you should take $40 million out of U.S. equity, is the recommendation, and put it into international equity. There's two primary reasons. One is you're currently overweight U.S. equity and underweight international equity. So, primary reason number one, that's what you should do. Rebalance back to policy. Now, we also will look at that from a tactical perspective and say, well, okay, the reason you are in that position is because international has underperformed U.S. So this is a little bit of trimming a winner and investing in a loser. Now, it also happens to be that if you look at a lot of investors that we look at for long-term strategy, they believe that that's actually you should have even more in international equity. And they actually believe that the future returns out of international securities will be much greater than U.S. Okay? So it's not necessarily that we will take that, but it's a confirming view of what we think is a good decision anyway.
I think it's fair to highlight that the $40 million that we're proposing today, that is very conservative. It's really just a toe in the rebalance, especially when we're as overweight as we are.
This is $40 million that's different than the $40 million.
Yes, lending. Very distinct. So, coincidence.
We're talking about $80 million today.
But that 40 for direct lending would take a year plus to get called down.
Right.
Okay.
And it might get absorbed by distributions from the existing investment in the manager. So I would just shelve that $40 million related to direct lending at the moment.
I agree that we should rebalance.
Okay.
I don't have a problem with rebalancing. I have an issue of where we rebalance to at times. And then I have an issue of where we take the money from. For instance, if we're going to take money out of U.S. equities, wouldn't it be more prudent to take out of Dodge and Cox equities than Capital Prospects?
Well, what I also look at, again, I look at policy, and your policy is 80% large cap, 20% small cap. Okay, and you're currently overweight small cap because it's done, again, for over this long period of time, it's done better than large cap. So, we're trimming kind of the winners of small cap.
Is the policy wrong? Maybe we should adjust the policy.
Your statement is so complex and deep than meets the eye. But 80-20 split is what the Russell 3000 benchmark more or less kind of follows. It's somewhat what we model when we do manager structure work, somewhat of an industry standard practice based upon the market capitalization that exists in the universe.
Yeah. So
I thought we were seeing large cap outperforming small cap in recent.
2014, that was the case.
2014, but then if you look at the first quarter.
Yep.
The big switch.
Big switch.
Switch back big time. So first quarter had a big small cap rally relative to large cap. Okay? So we kind of look at, in long term, small cap has done well. And that's where this overweight is coming from. So we're saying, okay, let's get back to policy and a rebalance. If we're going to do some rebalancing, let's be smart about it and get back to essentially policy. Okay? And so that's why of this rebalancing, half of it's coming out of small cap and half of it's coming out of large cap. Basically getting back to a relatively neutral position within U.S. equity and a relatively neutral position between U.S. and international.
But international is not doing so hot right now.
It's not that it's doing very well year to date. So the last 3 months, it's doing very, very well. Over the last few years, it hasn't done as well as U.S. equities.
But now, because
there's all kinds of uncertainty.
Right. Well, Joan, I mean, there's uncertainty everywhere.
Right.
The expectation, though, is that international will have better returns because of their quantitative easing, just like the U.S. equities did.
Right.
Whereas now the U.S. is going to turn around and supposedly increase the interest rates. Then it would be less attractive to invest in U.S. Equities.
Spot on.
The value of the dollar have more to do with that?
I watch BBC.
Yes and no. We look at currencies over the long term, which is the goal of this plan, as more or less a zero-sum game. Currencies matter in the short run. They tend to equal out over the longer period.
How do you factor in the negative interest rates in Europe?
I would say that's very attractive to equities.
Right.
They're forcing savers to put their dollars into higher yielding assets. Negative interest rates in Europe are a tailwind to equities.
So you don't see negative interest rates as a precursor to problems?
No.
I mean, that's
there, a, no, not that's as a riddle. Yeah, that could happen, but you could look at the U.S. and most of the problems happen when the interest rates were higher than they are now. So the interest rates, they're reducing the interest rates to stimulate the economy, to create growth.
So people are buying 8-year negative interest rate bonds. for what reason? They feel things are going well in the country? They
I go back to, if you look at, this is being, to some degree, is an investment philosophy. Is, do you want to be a contrarian, or do you want to follow the pack?
Well,
and I look at,
how do you take history on something that hasn't happened?
Well, you can actually look at the U.S. and say, when
we were negative, it would do what?
We didn't go negative.
Right.
Okay, but we did go through the quantitative easing.
I'm asking, what is the implication of a negative interest rate? To me, if I'm not even trust putting my money with the government, I have concerns.
The governments are doing is they're saying, yes, you want to. People are risk are being averse, and they are. The government is essentially charging them to hold their money, saying, mm-hmm. You don't want to take any risk. That's fine. It's going to cost you.
And people are doing it because they.
Well, everybody invests for different reasons.
They don't want to take any risk.
Right.
There's no way to put a rope around everyone's interest.
So just like in the United States, when it's relative. So if you're not gaining any return on your savings or your fixed income, like everybody else says, well, I need a return. So what? I'm not getting it from investing here, so. They're encouraging people. They're encouraging risk taking, and that's really what they want to do. Is they want to encourage risk taking.
Encouragement over there, or a result of some of that situation is money over there investing over here. Because
absolutely.
They're encouraging people. We don't have high interest rates, but we do have security.
Right.
We have the one, international or the one national entity that has.
That's a really good point, Mike.
So they may be taking money and putting it in the United States stock market as a safer place.
They're putting it into their own stock market to get a return. And then, this is a risk versus return. They're encouraging people to take risk. Obviously, they're expecting the people to invest in their own economies versus saying, I'm going to invest in the U.S.
And then there are some older retired people who say, I've got my 100 G's, I don't want to lose it. I'll pay a negative 0.5% so that I guarantee that my 100 G's less than 0.5% is going to be there.
Right. It's hard to, I was talking to somebody earlier today, an economist, and they were saying the Swiss, which I wouldn't say that's a risky economy, they're actually charging 75 basis points for their to invest with them, okay? But you would say, well, I can either, why don't I just literally take the money and put it in my mattress? And, well, one of the things they did to discourage that is they took away all the large bills. So they'd have to get a big pile.
Is that right? A big
mattress. So they'd have to have a shopping bag full of money if they wanted to take it out of the bank. Which I was like, they're really going to... thinking about how people, these things to make sure that people, don't make it easy for people.
I just have an emotional hurdle when you talk about taking money from the domestic United States market and going, we call it international or emerging markets. And I'm thinking Argentina, riots every day, Spain, 25% of the government's corrupt. It just doesn't make sense.
I just don't believe that there's any purely any country investments. Everything is so multinational that it's, anyways.
And we're not making any country-specific recommendations.
This is more...
No, I'm talking about even the ones that are considered U.S. U.S. Equities aren't necessarily strictly just U.S. I mean, anyways.
Headquarters in Ireland.
If we wrap that other item into this one, we're already at 7.3% and on alternatives.
5.3.
Well, that's what we're reading here.
That's what I'm reading here.
That includes direct lending, real estate.
Right. We're already at 7.3% in an asset class.
Total alternatives.
Tops out at 8%.
No, it tops out at 14%.
Actually, this is the short-term policy. If you look at the...
8%?
No,
13.5%. But it says
policy range?
It says here 8?
That's wrong. That's the short... If you look at the way I'm looking at this, there's a... If you go to the... there's a kind of an interim policy.
Yeah.
And then there's a long-term policy.
All right.
Okay. So if you looked at what page is that in the...
page three of the flash report.
Might I explain? Okay.
Please. Please do.
We have a long-term asset allocation policy for the alternative asset class, and it's 13.5%. When we first started funding the alternative class, I think SIS decided that they knew that we weren't going to get to that 13.5% very quickly. So instead of always having an asset class, an asset allocation that's so far off, they gradually graded in our contributions to this asset class, and they picked points in time, they picked asset allocations in points in time where we thought we should be, where they thought that we should be at a certain point in time until we reached that full deployment.
So when it says policy, it doesn't actually mean policy.
More of a short-term.
It's a short-term policy.
It's sort of policy.
I would like us to look at the long-term asset allocation.
Right.
I
think that would be, helpful.
That's opposed to the 14 in your cover?
What's that?
Is that different than the 14 in the cover?
Yeah.
Correct. In the cover?
It's 13.5.
It's 13.5,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
That's rounding.
Well, at least that's closer. Then it is on the other page.
Thank you, Donna. That's an important distinction.
No, I just need to, because if we're already at 7.3 and we're talking about putting another $40 million in there, I want to make sure we're not over our 8%.
No, we've got a long ways to go. Right.
Okay. But I was confused.
Certainly.
And that's coming, again, that's coming from the numbers on the flash report.
Okay.
Where you see two different policies.
Okay.
Are we going to get ourselves in a place where every time the market shifts and one asset class outperforms another, we're going to have to change policy?
Gosh, I rebalance every quarter.
Huh?
I rebalance my portfolio at home every single quarter.
But they want to do reasonable. I have to wait.
Thank you.
In the U.S. equities,
we're talking about policy, not moving money.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, we are talking about both. We're talking about both policy and moving money. The policy is this, and we need to stay within that policy range, and rebalancing is just a normal investment practice that brings us back into line with what we've agreed with.
Thanks, Jill.
We've already set those parameters.
With your
I just was confused about what those parameters were because I'm seeing a lot of different numbers and it was unsettling for
me. It's any equity does well until it doesn't.
Yeah.
And that's what we want. I mean, it sounds like it sounds funny, but really, we're getting to the point where we think it's not going to do as well anymore based on the economic indicators.
Upside potential. So... But in my opinion, you rebalance down to the lower performers because, like with a mutual fund, okay? So it's doing really well, and those shares become extremely expensive, and every time you put your money in, you're getting fewer and fewer and fewer shares, okay? You put that into the lower performing, and now you're getting just gobs of shares every single time. So you build up that lower performer, and over time, with dollar cost averaging, you make more money. And rebalancing is an important part.
Well, I agree with that. However, I mean, look at it in a different industry. If you have a 320 baseball hitter, right, and he's hit 320.
Okay, at least I keep going to investments.
He goes into a slump.
That up so you can put on it, replace him with a guy who's batting 250.
Maybe he needs more
practice.
Yeah,
with the 320 guy,
Josh
now
Hamilton,
he wants $200 million.
No, the Dodgers bought him.
Okay, the guy with the 320, his arm gets really tired,
so
and you've got to rotate out the other guys.
My only point is the formula should be used for guidance, and it has a fundamental wisdom to it, but it shouldn't be a Bible.
Right. No, and it's more of a lot of times what I look at when you're talking about rebalancing, if you don't want to rebalance into somebody, they should be gone, because then you're basically not happy with them. Okay, but there's and the whole idea I think is rebalancing takes away what I call this human nature risk of taking what's what you've seen most recently and extrapolating it into the future. And I think that's what we're trying to do, is be systematic and say, okay, I want to be balanced. And this is what this recommendation is. Let's get back to balance.
Okay, so we got two things. We got B and D here.
Yes, we do.
So do we want to act on them at the same time?
It can be part of the same conversation in terms of, do we want to balance, where we want to rebalance to, including keeping an eye on the direct lending, and do we want to add more money? Do we want to add the $15 million now, the full $40 million, which coincidentally seems to be the same amount that we are going to rebalance, or we're overbalanced in the equities?
Yeah, that $40 million number is just a coincidence.
Coincidentally, yes.
I think we should have a motion to settle this thing here.
Okay, I'll make a motion.
Which one?
On 7B.
Okay.
Okay, I'll make a motion. B, 7B.
The direct lending question.
Yes. I'll make a motion that we move $40 million into one of the two direct lenders, and you can come back with us with Raven. Oh, no, let's do it with Raven.
You're bold.
And then review our rebalancing with the asset liability study in the fall.
So not make a move, don't act on D, just act on D, B for now?
Well, or two separate questions?
That's the motion, yeah.
Yeah. As
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I thought we were on D.
He's doing both.
We're doing both.
Yeah, okay.
Get us out of here.
And on D, they have the other, okay.
No, we just follow the staff recommendation on D.
Yeah, on D.
To do the $15 million?
I don't agree with taking how we're taking the money out.
Okay, we're still on B. So
I added D. Go with staff recommendation on D. B is to move the $40 million into
Can somebody read it back?
Raven.
So is that okay? You made a motion on B originally to move $40 million to Raven.
Raven.
Okay, and then you subsequently made a second motion to, there was another discussion.
Part B.
That has to do with the asset liability study in the fall. And review our direct lending, whether or not we want to continue. That was one of the questions. Do we want to continue direct lending into perpetuity, or do we want to limit it? But let's make that decision when we do the asset liability in the fall.
But then why would we commit the whole $40 million if we're not going to just?
Well, we don't know that.
I mean, why wouldn't we just commit the $15 million and do the asset study in the fall?
Because I want to get the larger savings.
Oh, sorry.
Are we talking about $40 million or $80 million?
We're talking about this is B, direct lending question.
Okay, that's $40 million, and then the
forty. Well, let's stick with B, $40 million.
$40 million
to direct lending.
Raven.
To Raven, and then we will based on staff recommendation, we will review our asset allocation in the fall.
In the fall, when we review it.
So that is our motion.
Yeah.
That is our motion. We need a second before we can do additional discussion.
Yeah. Well, I'm not seconding it until
me
second
either.
I think that's the direction.
Okay. Now we have a motion and a second. Now we can discuss.
Where is the $40 million coming from?
It will come from domestic equities.
Okay. So where in domestic equities?
Okay. This is not a $40 million slug.
Okay.
It'll be drawn over time.
And
so
that's not what the motion here said. But.
No, but that is actually, we talked about it.
Right.
So just to add on to the point John just, and it's a very, very important point. Raven has modeled that most of a $40 million commitment, the dollars would actually come from our existing investment as it rolls off. Fund 3 would catch those funds rolling off, and now we have a rollover. So when it comes from where this is going to be allocated, probably 10, only 10, maybe to 15 million would actually come from domestic equities. So that's a good question, Mike, and the answer is equally as important to highlight.
Okay.
Well, and couldn't we also, as funds roll off of the other lenders,
absolutely.
Could that roll into it? So we wouldn't necessarily be pulling that much money from the domestic equities, depending on when the other.
That's another good point. The whole thing could be functionally funded from our existing direct.
Direct lenders.
Very good point.
I hate to complicate things, but. So given what you just said, we still will never reach that 7.5%.
No, as Michael mentioned, that's why we do need to bring it up again at our asset liability.
We can discuss that in November.
Yep. Okay, so we have the motion, second. I'm going to call the question. Do we need any additional discussion?
Roll call vote, please.
Well, wait,
okay.
No.
So
this is $40 million from domestic, from somewhere.
Named $40 million.
Over a period of time, it's a little bit uncertain. And some, maybe all of which, or most of which, would actually come from the proceeds of the current direct lending program.
To the extent possible.
Spot on.
So we're, for an uncertain period of time, from uncertain sources, the only defined purpose here is that we're giving it to Raven, which I have absolutely no problem with.
The period of time will be specified, because the manager has to call it within its investment period, which will probably be a 24-month period.
It ends, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the other part of this is the rebalancing, taking some money out of domestic equities and putting it in international.
Let me just add one more thing now that you mentioned that, Jim. We're always pulling money from our various investments to pay off our monthly
payroll.
Mm-hmm. So it's always happening. So right. That's nothing new. So this is just a little, in rebalancing, we're just, again, putting it where we said before we wanted it to be. I'm just saying. Anyway, so are we ready to call a question?
Can you restate the question
one more time? I just want to make sure.
I think Kelly has 7B.
It really reads out the same as the staff recommendation that was noted there. The only difference is to commit $40 million instead of the $15 million. It says agree to commit $40 million to Raven refund and wait until the asset liability study in the fall before deciding on whether to continue into this fund in this asset class.
It's perfect.
Fair enough. Okay. Roll call, please. Roll call vote.
Maria DeAnda?
Yes.
Donna Riley?
No.
Gordon Ford?
No.
Mike Lynch?
No.
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
Michael O'Neill?
Yes.
Ty.
Could have been stained.
I would like to propose an alternative. That we drop it down to the 15 that was stated in the original staff recommendation, and I would be willing to support that.
And just make that motion.
I make that motion.
But the other one didn't pass. What was the vote?
It's a tie.
It's a tie.
3-3.
I'm going to go 1-2.
And it would all come out.
No,
that's
4-2.
No.
3-3.
3-3.
Donna was against.
Okay, so everything remains the same except the $40 million down to 15.
Yes.
Okay, I'll second that.
So we have a new motion.
Is it fair to highlight the board seat that Raven mentioned and the threshold for Stansar to have a board seat?
Nate brings up a good point. Raven did say that if we agreed to commit at least $25 million now, we would earn a board seat. We would get a board seat, kind of like what we have right now.
Could we get a board seat if we waited till the fall?
No.
Which board seat does...
Jeff Grover holds it currently.
Right.
Oh, Jeff is on the Raven one?
He's on the Raven LPAC committee.
So we get another
board seat?
No, it starts over.
Well, let me...
That's only for fun one.
So this just locks us into actually doing nothing until the fall, right?
If we
voted the $40 million. If I change my vote, what I'm voting on is giving Raven $40 million now and... So we will rebalance after more discussion in the fall.
We'll decide whether we want to just continue to fund this asset class on a continuing basis. Then.
Right.
Whether it fits into the portfolio.
But that still commits us to this fund
right.
for
does.
Right. Some really,
I don't have a problem
years.
With Raven.
Yeah, another 3 to 5 years.
I don't have a problem with Raven at all.
I don't have a problem with Raven. I just don't know that we want to commit to another 3 to 5 years without more discussion of the portfolio as a whole. That's my concern, okay, is that I would rather go with the 15 now and then look at the entire thing globally in the fall.
Do we intend to have the rebalancing vote after this vote? We do. Then
two separate votes.
Okay, so we have a motion.
You just lost my motion.
For the same exact motion, except it's a different
It's 15.
Within 15 million.
Who second, Donna?
Nine.
Do you want to revise your motion?
Jim seconded.
Yeah.
Now, is the other one tied in with this too, the rebalancing?
No, they're
separate.
Oh, now you separate.
Totally separate.
Yeah, this is just the $15 million for Raven until the fall when we talk about it as a whole.
And we're going to have to come back to 17 then.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's $15 million or $40 million. 70, I think, was more important.
Yeah, well, there's a motion and a second on the floor.
So, what's your call
question? Okay, we have a motion and a second. Do we have any additional discussion? Call, okay. Roll call.
Horton Ford?
No.
Maria DeAnda?
Yes. Compromise.
Donna Riley?
Yes.
Mike Lynch?
No.
Not to pressure you, but...
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
Michael O'Neill?
Yes.
Motion passes 4-2 to commit $15 million to Raven, refund, and wait until the asset liability study in the fall before deciding on whether to continue to disfund in this asset class.
Okay. Righty. So that takes us to D, 7B, and this is a rebalancing question.
This one makes the most sense, really, if you follow the staff recommendation.
I'll second that.
I'll make that motion.
I forgot what the staff recommendation
right
was. We have a motion?
Yes.
Yeah, and a second.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I slipped that one. I apologize. So we have a motion and a second to rebalance, taking $40 million as recommended by staff. $7 million from taking $40 million from U.S. equity and $7 million from Legato, $13 million from Capital Prospects, $20 million from Mellon Capital, and increase international equity by the $40 million.
One question. I still don't understand why I wouldn't take it all from above.
Okay, let me just finish reading this. $22 million of the $40 will go to LSV and $18 million to Pyramus. So we have motion to second. Now we can discuss.
My concern is a month ago I was prepared to vote to take the
sure.
to shut up Legato.
Right, and that very well may happen.
You guys said we need to wait for a study. So now we have this, and I don't see a study.
The board told me at that meeting to bring that issue with Legato back in May or August based on the first quarter audit results or the second quarter.
Correct.
And so we will discuss Legato, but I think it's a tad premature right now based on the direction I got from the board.
Okay, but we know Capital Prospects is a better performer. Why wouldn't we leave
balance their outperformance?
There's two, you know, Legato brings two things to the table. In
losses.
Small cap.
They bring losses.
They bring small cap growth exposure, which they do, and active management relative to the small cap growth exposure. It's kind of the other piece, that second piece.
Yeah, it's the guy who loses the bet to offset the guy who wins.
Right.
Yeah.
But you still need but you do not want to take all the money out of a small cap growth manager and leave you a hole in the portfolio.
Well, I'd go get another small.
Well, right.
Very well do
right.
That
and that's
still take the whole.
That's still an option. But we're saying in the interim, we'd want to balance the portfolio so it's, you know, there are no incidental bets within the portfolio, like a hole in small cap growth. Okay, so that's what's behind this particular recommendation. If that, and which I think is should be separate from should Legato be there or not. So one of them is a portfolio construction saying I want a balanced portfolio, and the second decision is should Legato be part of that portfolio. And we're just
but obviously when we're taking more money from the other ones, it's they're influencing the decision here. Their presence influences the decision, or the desire to keep them alive until we do a study.
I don't know, but we can definitely call the question. So unless we have any further discussion, do we want to do a roll call?
Yes.
Let's do a roll call on the rebalancing as proposed by staff.
Gordon Ford?
No.
Maria DeAnda?
Yes.
Donna Riley?
Yes.
Mike Lynch?
No.
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
Michael O'Neill?
Yes.
Motion passes 4-2.
Thank you. Alrighty, I got a few gray hairs today. With that, that takes us to the report by...
Okay, this is going to be a 42-minute report. I'm going to be very thorough. We're going to start with how to price a derivative.
All right.
Excellent.
I learned something.
By hand. No calculators.
I was going to say, where's our Black Scholes?
That's right.
Let's do this. Option pricing model.
Wow.
Let's go.
We're ready.
My star pupil.
They're sick. They're so sick.
My star pupil. There you go. Gotcha.
It's financial humor at its best.
Or its saddest. You know, you choose.
All right. Well, we got a chance to hear a lot about how the globe is spending by Matt Clark from PIMCO, so I won't regurgitate all of that. But we saw in the month of March, large cap give back some return while small cap raced ahead. Small cap, it's fair to note, year to date has been doing fairly well, beating their large cap counterpart. One reason in particular, most small cap companies do business in the U.S., so the currency issue is not affecting them. In fact, if anything, they're gaining from it if they have to purchase equipment from overseas. So that's been a tailwind. Currency, strong U.S. dollar is positive for small cap securities. Year to date, we see the international equities doing quite strong all the way around the cap space, where the EFI, which stands for Europe, Australia, and the Far East, are also known as more developed nations, returning 5% over the last 3 months, leading everything except for small cap growth in the U.S. We look at the currencies. I want to make sure you guys are looking at the same page. You guys are familiar with the page, I think. Okay. You see the currencies over the trailing year, the euro down 22% to the dollar, yen 14, pound 10. That all, generally speaking, a weak currency is signals strong. There's a correlation to strong equity markets, so that harks back to our previous conversation. And then the debt space kind of chugging along. The Barclays Ag up 46 basis points for the month and around a percent and a half year to date. EM and high yield kind of fluttering back and forth year to date over the last 3 months, around 2.5%. Now let's look at our portfolio. For the month, gave back a few. We'll look at the total dollar amounts, but I'm on page two, right here. The five themes the market saw. We had a tough winter. You wouldn't know it if you lived in California, but if you're on the East Coast, that did put a hamper on some GDP for the first quarter. We've already talked about Europe's stimulus. A couple tidbits. Europe's economy, not yet even back to where it was in 2008. Kind of interesting to note. Also, their unemployment around 11%. That's bad, but it's good. We live in a weird world where bad news is good news in terms of equity markets, and good news is bad news in terms of equity markets.
It's 22 in Spain.
I actually met with the Spanish ambassador in 2010. The economy was doing really well, and we asked him, why you have 25% unemployment? He said it's a mystery. Didn't make me feel good. Okay. Three, energy continues to be a hot topic, but has stabilized around the mid-50s. Gas prices, especially in California, mid-$3. Doesn't feel as good as I would have hoped it to. Currencies, we've already talked about that. Geopolitical scandals, always exciting. We see Petrobras had a $14 billion write-off in Brazil related to political scandal. There was a number of nuances in front running there. That always shakes the markets, but long term it's good because regulators get in and shake things up. Page three, the month gave back at the top level.
Give some money to the Clintons.
Oh, shoot from the hip, Mr. DeMartini. How like that. Okay, I gave around $10 million back.
They probably already have.
from February, the total fund gave up about $10 million, but year to date, trailing 1 year, the fund up after benefits and everything around $95 million. Page four, I hope gets into returns. And it does. We see the total fund down a little less than 0.5%, 38 basis points, right in line with the policy index. You can see U.S. equities gave up around 68 basis points, right on top of its benchmark, more or less. Cap Prospects continues to do well. Legato, not great. Dodge & Cox, it's given up a little bit over the last run, but they had a very, very strong 2012, 2013, and 2014. And the plan made a smart decision by staying with them when they were underperforming, coming out of the depths of the crisis.
Can I just make one observation there?
You know what I'm going to say.
Huh? Yeah, well, this is a great example of what I'm talking about, though. Look at fiscal year to date. There's the alpha, which is negative, mm-hmm. but small cap growth, their actual nominal return much greater than Capital Prospects.
Oh, you're talking about Legato versus Capital
Legato
Prospects.
Legato versus Capital Prospects.
Looking at the far right column.
This is where I'm talking about. Is you would have had a hole there, and you would actually lost the benefit of being in small cap growth. So that's why we want to do the balance, is to capture those two characteristics. So you don't want to, as I would say, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, at least convince most of the board. Whether Legato's effective.
Correct.
That's just beta exposure to right. the asset.
I'm saying that's why you want to rebalance versus you want to, the part of this is rebalancing small cap growth. Happens that Legato's there, and like I said, the Legato decision versus somebody else is somebody else. Is a different decision. Right.
Well, except that we make the decision to take X dollars from Capital at Y dollars from Legato. We're making the judgment right there.
Yep.
But
it's the balance between those two.
Yeah. Okay. International equities, we have LSV give up a little bit for the month. Pyramus likewise, but strong alpha. Look at that far right column. Really great yin to the yang, if you will. Pyramus up 240 basis points on a relative basis versus LSV down 25. That combines for a real strong 1.07% of excess return. That said, we see that the international space has stubbed its toe over the last 12 months. 3 months doing much better. Fixed income, chugging along, rather low volatility there. And real estate, beginning to ramp up. You see that absolute return at 12% for the fiscal year. Trailing the policy index, which is going to be continued to revised as we have more private investments. That's just the REIT. And
how's April looking?
Choppy, but better in the international space. You see the emerging market, China, is stock market is just skyrocketing. They've lifted different regulations that allow mainland Chinese to invest in Hong Kong, which for them is basically the world. You get outside of mainland China and have your investments in Hong Kong. That's the access to the rest of the world, and that's just floodgates. Every day they have a limit, and they've been hitting that limit of how much they can invest. When you look at the population at Harvard.
We're still about 4% away from being in a bogey this year, and we've got 3 months left, so that's kind of what I would have.
Last page, page six, just direct lending. This is not really meaningful until we get to the quarterly reports. And that's that. We have the top 10. I'll fly through that. If you look on page one of the top 10, Microsoft is out of business. They're only trading at a dollar. No. That's my mistake.
Thank you.
They're actually up 2% for the year, for the month. That's the flash crash fat finger. Say that 10 times fast. Everything else is, I can go through this. If anything jumps out, I have a motion for nope. I'll second that. That concludes.
You got a blaze again?
Yep.
He actually does.
Boise, Idaho.
You want us to do your exit?
No, I'm at the pleasure of the board, sir. Okay.
Question?
I have a question. If you look at PIMCO's report,
okay.
page 8, where it talks about economic settlement.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, I'm there.
Talk about that.
Wow. It's open mic.
Well, I was thinking like the European stuff is not doing all that well. And yet, we want to shift from...
We already agreed to shift.
We did it.
Yeah, so this is looking at historical data. And
it's not current, it's past history?
Yes.
Correct.
That's what happened already.
The year
2005.
What we did, we're betting against continued success.
It's old news.
As yeah. States.
Yesterday is old news.
Alrighty. Are we still on with the top 10 or are we done?
Top 10 has concluded.
Thank you.
I just would like to point out something that I talked to Jim about, and if you look at the PIMCO, they were awarded in it doesn't matter. Page 1. They were awarded the 2013 Morningstar Fund Fixed Income Manager of the Year for 2013.
All right.
If you look at the quarterly value added 2013, they didn't make a dime.
But they did.
They didn't lose.
But they didn't lose anything.
They were the loss leaders.
Okay. Do we have anything for closed session? Okay. With that, we'll go to members forum.
Okay. I have nothing today.
Thank you.
Our pleasure, as always.
Yes. I really do need the name of that turf builder.
Oh,
Terminator.
Terminator.
The guy who gets rid of the lawn and puts in something like this.
Me too.
I need that.
They pay it for you. Apparently, you don't have to pay anything out of pocket.
Well, let us know how that goes.
Oh, yeah.
It's like solar.
Hopefully, better. Somehow.
Don't say anything. I'm just going to invest in solar. I'm just about...
27?
Do it.
I did. It just needed to
solar
go
and a, solar and a battery. Go ahead, future.
Sorry.
You should go out to that castle, the solar professor for UC Merced. He's the second ranked guy in the world in that country.
Oh.
He's got
see what's
battery
happening.
Stuff.
Yeah, I don't know what car I'm bringing.
Kathy? Rick?
I'm still trying for the day.
Joey?
Just a reminder that we don't have a meeting in the first part of May. Our next meeting will be May 26th.
Show up, we won't be here.
Big suckers.
The next meeting is
26. Okay, with that.
All right.
We are adjourned.